What on Earth is the Church is our series title, and we're looking at what we're hoping or intending to be at St. Helens, and because even if they're honourable, our intentions aren't always biblical, we perhaps ought to say it's what we're meant to be here at St. Helens. I was reading this week someone who once came up with this paragraph. Went like this. He said, "It can be exalting to belong to a church that is 500 years behind the times and sublimely indifferent to fashion. It is mortifying to belong to a church that is 5 minutes behind the times, huffing and puffing to catch up." Well, I hope you understand the sense in which he wrote it, and it's in that spirit that we're going back to the Bible to find the answers to our question for this series. And today we're in 1 Peter. And it'll be a big help to me, and I think to you, if you've got it open in front of you, it's page 216, 217 in the New Testament sections of the Bibles. 1 Peter chapter 2. And though we're studying verses 4 to 8, it's actually verses 4 and 5 that give the main thrust. Verses 6 to 8 come by way of an explanation. So let me read them to you again. "Come to him, to that living stone rejected by men, but in God's sight chosen and precious. And like living stones, be yourselves built into a spiritual house, to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." Now, the picture is a clear one, isn't it? The picture that Peter is giving us is of the church as a spiritual house or temple. And the lessons, I'm afraid, that I've worked through from these verses are almost embarrassingly elementary, so I hope you'll forgive me. It's simply laying foundations. Here's the first of them. One, the church is to be Christ-centered. Well, you can't get much more elementary than that, can you? See, when I ask the question, how do I join this temple, how do I join this spiritual house, the answer is not by coming to the temple or to any building. No, verse 4, I'm to come to him, to that living stone, to Jesus, to the Christ. And Peter goes on to describe him in remarkably encouraging terms for his readers. See, look again at verse 4, will you? "Come to him, to that living stone, rejected by men, but in God's sight, chosen and precious." Now remember who he's writing to. He's writing to Christians who are facing an increasingly hostile world. Indeed, persecution seems to be just over the horizon. Now, wouldn't you find it encouraging to be told this? I mean, you're meant to think of yourself as part of the church, part of God's family. Indeed, all those descriptions in verse 9 we'll come on to in a few weeks' time are the ones you're claiming to be part of, a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, and everyone is ganging up against you. You feel weak and helpless and feeble and in a desperate minority. Don't the doubts start to creep in? The description and reality don't seem to tally, do they? So Peter reminds them of the one who's at the heart of it all, who's the pivot of this church, who's the focus of it all. He understands he was in precisely that situation, rejected by men, weak, feeble, helpless, in a tiny minority, rejected. And yet still, God's chosen and precious one. Now, I think Peter's readers would have been thrilled to read verse 4 and encouraged to discover they could still be the church and rejected by men. Indeed, we'll need to remember that truth if we're going to keep our nerve. See, the pressure is constantly on the church, whether we're in Eastern Europe and facing true persecution. And how comforting these words must be to them. Or whether we're simply in our situation in the West. The pressure is always on us to reverse this. We're constantly wanting to be the church that is chosen by men. That's why the church is desperately anxious that it's 5 minutes behind the times and huffing and puffing to catch up. We want to be acceptable, respectable, in tune with the way others think, the sort of place people would look up to. In some ways, of course, all of those things are right and proper. The danger is we do it and reverse the whole of the phrase, become chosen by men and rejected by God. Now, we need to have the nerve to be 500 years behind the times if necessary. Our Christ, our cornerstone, was rejected by men, but in God's sight, chosen and precious. And he's at the center of the church. Now, of course, it's not just an encouraging little verse, this. It is actually something sweepingly radical. See, all the barriers of the Jewish temple are being rewritten in these paragraphs. The you who are to come to him in verse 4, the you who are to be built into a spiritual house in verse 5, included Gentiles as well as Jews. Oh yes, now it is Christ, not your passport, so to speak, who is the one who distinguishes church from non-church, true from false. Those courtyards in the Jewish temple, you remember, you know, not beyond here if you're Gentile, not beyond here if you're proselyte, not beyond here if you're woman, not beyond here if you're not priest. No, those are going. Have you come to him or not? Is the only dividing line. Now, there's no change of God's mind in suddenly introducing this thought. It's been the plan from the very beginning. That is why verses 6 to 8 keep quoting the Old Testament to show that God's plan was always to build his church round this cornerstone. And Peter's saying that Jesus is that very stone. Christ is the centerpiece for people or their stumbling block. Here is the Bible's great division of mankind. We're all divided either into church or non-church. And it actually has very little to do with where we spend our Sundays. It focuses around a relationship to this living stone of verse 4. See, we're church if we're, in the words of verse 6, he who believes in him. Or verse 7, you therefore who believe. Or verse 4, you who come to him. And the Greek words got the sense of drawing near with the intention of staying and fellowshipping. I'm non-church. If in the language of verse 7, I'm amongst those who do not believe. Which is explained in verse 8 as those who disobey. It's an unpalatable truth, isn't it, that belief in New Testament terms has very little to do with that emotional appeal to have faith and everything to do with obedience or disobedience to God's chosen Christ. So please understand, the church is those who come to him. The promises given to God's church is for those who come to him. And if you haven't or don't know how, please ask. It's not meant to be a barrier there that we can all hide the other side of and gloat at those who've not crossed. There's nothing we'd love more than to be able to explain how to come to him. This church is Christ-centered. This household is Christ-centered. Christ is the one we have to come to belong. Christ is the one who constitutes the church. He is the living stone, the cornerstone, the head of the corner. You know, that's why when people talk about our church, particularly when the layman talks about our church, it's encouraging to hear it because it's normally a way of saying we belong. When clergy speak about our church or my church, it's normally discouraging to hear it because it's our way of saying we own it. And it's not that way round. Christ constitutes the church, not the Pope. Hello, it is very striking, isn't it, as Peter uses this metaphor, how he leaves himself out. Just come back to the gospel reading we had, to Matthew 16. Keep a finger in 1 Peter, we're coming straight back. But as this verse has been quoted and misquoted so often, it's worth just seeing this point. Matthew 16, verse 18. Peter's made his great declaration of faith in who Jesus is. And Jesus answers him in verse 17, and he goes on, Matthew 16, 18, "And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the powers of death shall not prevail against it. You're Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." Now, many is the interpretation that has made Peter, as a result of this verse, the pivot of the whole church, and how he comes to be the first bishop of Rome, and it's those who are linked in that line with him that are actually the cornerstone and the foundation of the whole church edifice. Well, don't you find it very telling that when Peter comes to write about the church, when he uses the imagery of rock and stone, the rock on which it's all built is not him. No, if anything, it's his declaration in verse 16 here, isn't it? The rock on which it's all built is the Christ, the Son of the living God. I mean, it's an amazing omission if that Matthew chapter is really meant to mean what we're told it is. See, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, he does not say, "Come to me, the rock on which the church will be built." He says, "Come to him, to that living stone." Now, it is Christ who constitutes the church. Neither Pope nor denomination. So let me try and make a simple application or two from this. It means we must not divide ourselves by denomination, doesn't it? I mean, at its simplest and its most obvious, at this communion service, I hope it's understood that we actually welcome all those who are believers, who are indeed coming to him, to that living stone, to join us at the Lord's Supper. But it's not just at the kind of one focal point service. We do need to keep examining our structures and our habits and our ways of doing things so we don't cut off people at St. Helens other than around Christ. We don't kind of disqualify people from the family other than on those grounds. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not disowning the Church of England when I say that. At least I hope I'm not. I'm very happy to be Anglican, but not at the point, if it ever comes, where it divides the family or the household. Because God's church is built on and centered on no denomination, no archbishop, but Christ. See, poor Dr. Runcie is not actually asked to be the focal point of the church. It's an awful job. Come to him. Well, we must be those who reflect that. A Christ-centered church. Secondly, a people-orientated church. Come to him, to that living stone, and like living stones, be yourselves built into a spiritual house. Now, I imagine we're all well enough taught to know that the church is people and not bricks and mortar. But it could hardly be put more clearly than here, could it? The paragraph is full of talk about bricks and mortar, or at least stones, and they're all people. Come to him, that living stone, and like living stones, be yourselves built. Life would have been a whole lot less confusing, wouldn't it, if they'd called the building where the church, that is you and I, meet, something other than church. It would have led to far less loose talk than we've got at the moment. I mean, on those occasional days when I'm really thinking biblically and properly, and people want to tell me about their church, and they say, "Well, our church is very old. It keeps reminding me of the vicar I met in Norfolk who told me what a tremendous age range he had in church the other Sunday. All the way from 80 to 92, he said. Well, slightly more seriously, you see, if we've got our thinking straight, it is actually very, you know, all this talk about the house of God is very loose talk, isn't it? It's very difficult to come to the house of God when you are the house of God. I mean, it is as striking as that, what the New Testament teaches. Don't look this up, but just listen to what Paul says to the Corinthians. This is 1 Corinthians 3:16 and 17. "Don't you know that you're God's temple," he says, "and that God's Spirit dwells in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him, for God's temple is holy, and that temple you are." What does it mean to come to the house of God? You know, those signs outside churches, and I discovered after I'd seen them around others, we've got one over the door there, which says this is the gateway to heaven. This is none other than the house of God. Please don't take that sign too seriously. It's not strictly true, at least not about the building. It becomes the house of God, I suppose, about 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning when we all get here. And in some senses ceases around 1 o'clock when we leave. You know, and it's very dangerous when we start talking about coming into the presence of God at the beginning of services. You know, as if when we come to church, that's what we've done. I'm afraid God is far more uncomfortably present than that. Now, forgive me, I'm not trying to just be a pedant and split hairs over words. There's one level on which none of that matters, except for the fact it keeps inducing us into thinking wrongly about this building. And so much of the church in this country is enslaved by its buildings. It's high time we thought the issue through more carefully. We've got ourselves inhibited as a church in this country by our buildings and by some kind of spiritual something or other that's attached to them. And what does happen when a building is consecrated? I mean, seriously, what's happened? I mean, it's set apart for the church to use. Well, that's fair enough. I remember Billy Graham getting on a sidetrack in one of his sermons and talking about all the different people and things he'd blessed, and he landed up saying, "I once blessed a golf club." He said, "I don't know what it means to bless a golf club, but I've done it." Well, it's a little bit like that consecrating a church, isn't it? It doesn't put spiritual magic into the stones. And you know, we've got to come to terms with that, because again, churches get split in horror about what goes on in them. Or again, I was hearing this week about the third or fourth church I've heard recently that seems to be near a split over the reordering of the church furniture. You know, what governs? What ought to govern our thinking about alterations we do to our buildings? Apart from all the legalities of listed buildings, let's put them on one side for a moment. If we think straight, what is governing the way we decide what we will or won't do? Diocesan bureaucracies really need to come to terms with the truth as to what the church is on this issue. Surely we ought to be governed first and foremost by why we meet together and whether the building fits that aim. And in the moment you say that, of course, you realize that most of the church buildings need changing. Now, I'm sure there are other issues that come along, and sooner or later taste will come into it, and that's when I bow out. I know I'm no expert. I'm not saying it's unimportant. For some people it's very, very important. I just wish we'd understand that that's what we're saying, though, at that point. This is my preference, taste-wise. Architecturally, that'll make a nonsense of it. Let's understand that that's the issue. And don't wrap it in a spiritual mist. As if somehow or other it's sacred, whether we've got this here or there or somewhere else. No, it is people. more than buildings we ought to be concerned for. The church is people. God's interest is people. The growth that God looks for is people growth, not building growth. That's what this paragraph's about. That's his concern. It ought to be ours. Great snare is we all get hung up on buildings or programs. Programs is just the kind of efficient way of avoiding the issue as well. Others of us are good at that. Growth, you see here. But just look again at verse 5. Because the growth that's being spoken of, the building work that's being spoken of, you see, isn't even in the terms that we normally think of growth. When people talk to me of my Christian growth or spiritual growth, I'm often thinking in terms of my holiness or my understanding or my discipleship. And all of those are included, obviously. But the emphasis here is in our common growth together, isn't it? Come to him, to that living stone, and like living stones, be yourselves built into a spiritual house. You're a stone, you're a stone, you're a stone, I'm a stone. And it's as if as we come to Jesus, we're drawn, of course, like spokes to a hub, closer together. And we're then to be shaped together into this spiritual house. So when I go to the road of the Lone Ranger discipleship, I'm breaking away from this growth. I'm actually making it very difficult for the rest of you to grow properly because there's a me-shaped gap that's missing in the building. Oh, this growth is painful. That's why we prefer the Lone Ranger approach. You see, it means we've got to rub shoulders with one another. We're going to be fitted into the same building together, and I've got a chip on my shoulder. And some of you have got some very rough edges on your shoulders. And it hurts when God's chisel gets to work. I mean, the honest truth is, isn't it, that when we're flung together closely with other people, we discover we don't fit naturally with just anyone else. Even monochrome St. Helens gives us enough of a hint of that. You know, we can imagine what it must be like in other church, local church families where they really have got the spectrum. Because we get just enough of a hint, even here, of the difficulties of different intellectual backgrounds, social class backgrounds, generation backgrounds. It's not actually just an age thing, that. Temperamental differences. That can make us difficult. And we haven't even mentioned our own more overt sinfulness difficulties. Now, I hope you can see, when churches get close, problems often arise, and they're not always a bad sign. Where there are no problems, it almost certainly means death. Only the dead don't mind who they lie next to, as one friend put it. But you see, here's the building plan. And we needn't worry about the problems and the pains because we are under construction. It's not finished. It won't be complete till the last day. And we better not get too grandiose an idea. I shall be the 433rd brick on the 27th row around the corner at the back. Well, wherever it is, that's where we'll be. But we're part of it. And there's no intention that there should be a hole in that row, in that space, round the corner at the back. And if we're coming to him, this is why, so that we're built into a spiritual house. You see, that come to him, verse 4, it's not really primarily an evangelistic call. He's writing for Christians. He's saying to them, look, come to him. Christ is that living stone, and we're to be like that living stone. And like living stones ourselves, we're to be built into a spiritual house together. Church must be people orientated. It's not the meeting I attend or the place I go to, but the family or the household I'm being shaped into. Is that the way I'm thinking? Christ-centered, people-orientated. And then thirdly, it has an inclusive ministry. Be yourselves built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. I think this paragraph must have been baffling to many of Peter's readers to begin with. He keeps using familiar language and then turning its meaning on its head. Priesthood, sacrifices are very familiar terms to anyone who knew their Bible. The Old Testament is riddled with them, and yet here they're very different. There's no elite about this priesthood. The sacrifices aren't animals or corn or whatever. They're spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. In Old Testament times, the priests would operate in the temple, the sacrifices would take place there, it would be in the cultic, ritualistic settings. Here Peter blows all these limitations out of the water, doesn't he? And the priesthood isn't for a few, it's for everyone. Sacrifices aren't a Sunday ritual. They're actually something that are offered all week. Remember how Paul wrote in Romans 12, I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God, present your bodies as a living sacrifice, which is acceptable to God. Well, Peter hasn't changed his meaning here. And as you go on and read through his letter, you'll discover that the spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God that he keeps talking about is an evangelistic holy lifestyle. Living a holy life in a hostile world. That's a task for all of us. And yet, you see, we keep on going back to the Old Testament. The Church of England keeps on trying to live as Jews rather than Christians. The Additional Curate Society is a Church of England society. Its aim is pretty laudable. It's to collect some money to fund one or two extra curates through college and so on. Speaking as a curate, I can't criticize the aim. It put out a calendar this year for all its adherents, I suppose, and each month had got a little doodle on the top and a kind of prayer. Here's February's. Almighty God, give us priests to offer the holy sacrifice of the altar. Well, may I say, that is just pure Old Testament talk. That wipes out the New Testament in one. I want us to be quite clear, that's not what's going on at this communion service this morning. And in case anyone has any illusions, just turn back, will you, for a moment. I think this is our last cross-reference to Hebrews chapter 9, page 208. Hebrews 9, verse 25. The writer speaking of Jesus' ministry. And this is what he says. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly, as the high priest enters the holy place yearly with blood not his own. For then he would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, Jesus has appeared once for all at the end of the age to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. Almighty God, give us priests to offer the holy sacrifice of the altar. Now please, don't send your checkbooks in that direction. The sacrifices that are going on and we think about today is one sacrifice that happened thousands of years ago, we remember. And if you like, though it ought to be under a separate category, there's the responsive sacrifice of our thanks and praise to that. Peter's sacrifices here in 1 Peter chapter 2 are far more wide-ranging than communion services. And you see, his priesthood is far more wide-ranging than the additional curate society ever imagines. It must have missed this verse. The church, you see, according to verse 5, the church does not have a priesthood. It is one. Now, we have got to learn to think in those terms. You see, verse 5 lifts us all up, doesn't it? We all have a huge job to do. Like living stones, be yourselves, all of you, built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood. Yes, to be a holy priesthood, not to have one. So we do need to be very, very careful, you see, how we restrict this term. The moment people ask the question, it's the great contemporary question, isn't it? You know, do you believe in women priests? You begin instantly, when you've been reading 1 Peter 2:5, to understand the problems. The great difficulty with the question is to work out what question you're actually being asked. I don't just mean that glibly. I'm sure the group that's been sort of studying it in the church are already working at that. What is the precise issue? Because at one level, of course, it's very simple to answer, do I believe in women priests, when I've read verse 5? There's only one answer, and it's yes. But it's not quite the question people are sometimes asking. Now again, don't misunderstand me. There is a ministry in the New Testament that people are set apart from, apart for. There is a ministry that people are set apart for. We'll come across it later on this autumn. Though it's striking, Peter himself mentions it at the end of his letter, but distant from where he's really laying the foundations about the church. And so it clearly is important that we work out very carefully how we mark off those we've set apart and how we don't, so that we don't blur the truth of verse 5. Let me just throw up two or three issues that I think as a church we'll need to think through in the coming months and years. Or maybe just say the coming months. For example, in a few minutes' time, there will be, for the more observant of you, a little shuffle around in the hymn when David stops leading the service and I take over leading it. Now, that's because we're coming to the communion bit. Now, I'm not wishing to say that there aren't circumstances, as in Corinthians, where it's good for the sake of decency and order that those who are responsible for the Lord's Supper are people with some position or authority. Not that David is without it as a lay reader. What I think we've got to ask ourselves is that the way the Church of England makes that line at the moment, which is that it restricts it to clergy, and not just clergy, by the way, but those who've been priested or presbytered, is at best unhelpful. Indeed, at best misleading, isn't it? As if there's something going on there that you've got to be only this someone to be able to do. Or again, what about the things that we make our clergy wear? Yeah, I mean, you know. Now, it's not so much that they're archaic or that they're kind of humorous, though there are times. I have a curate friend who took his cassock to be dry cleaned, and he went to collect it, and they didn't quite know what to charge him for it. And there was a big sort of fuss in the shop, and they held it up and examined it, and they said, oh, it's an evening dress, isn't it? So that's what to the average man in the street we're wearing. Well, now, that's not really my quibble. I don't mind being a fool for Christ's sake, though I take some convincing at times that it's for Christ's sake. But I've got to say this. Putting ministers in this dress, the thing that worries me is, isn't it actually misleading about what the ministry is about? Doesn't it too easily leave the impression that it's the ministers are the ones who dress up, the ministers are the ones who conduct ceremonies? I don't think we'll discover later on in the autumn that that is the heart of the ministry the New Testament sets people aside for. Or let's take one that will affect all of us straight away. You see, our danger at St. Helens will be that we make a priesthood not actually of your clergy, but of the staff. That's where the line will come, subtly or otherwise. That's where the expectation line will come. See, the expectation is that if you've got someone who's paid to do a job, they do it all. Again, it's striking on this additional curate society. Later on, their other months have got things like, Almighty God, give us priests to pray for the afflicted. Give us priests to comfort mourners. Now, I have no objection whatsoever. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying there's anything wrong in doing those things. I just want to say, why do we need priests to do them, especially? Because the moment we shove those kind of jobs on towards the priest figure, what are you leaving yourselves with? You know, we sitting here, of course, always love to be wanted, so we'll take anything that everyone shoves towards us. There's an extraordinary situation where congregations shove responsibilities where they don't belong and then land up bereft and denuded of them and rudderless. Now, I was told this week of a Reed Mart Loan weekend, this is some time ago, some years back now, where people were examining the gifts of the Spirit and they were doing a kind of self-assessment. And the biggest, the commonest factor amongst that Reed Mart Loan group was a sense of redundancy. See, they looked at their gifts, and most of them had gifts that were kind of, if you've got to label them, caring gifts. When it came to teaching gifts, they thought they didn't have them. Therefore, there was nothing to do. I don't know whether their self-assessment was right or wrong, but the caring bit was likely to be right, isn't it? We've got a lot of people from the caring professions. It's quite highly probable that that's where our gifts and aptitude lie. Whether people were or weren't teachers is actually neither here nor there. The worrying thing is the conclusion. Because I can care but can't teach, therefore, there's nothing for me to do. Let me say, therefore, there's everything for us to do. We really won't have a congregation this size without having people under pressure. Maybe temporarily, maybe more long term. It really honestly doesn't take too many people to be under pressure, no more probably than three or four, and you'll quickly exhaust the staff if they're meant to do the caring. And yet we've got a kind of built-in mechanism, haven't we, that discovers someone's in need, and our first thought is, tell the staff. Oh, Hugh, do you know, so-and-so is under a lot of pressure at the moment. The implication is, could I or could I get someone in the staff to do something about it? And I'm not saying that we're not in the slightest bit interested and don't want to know and we'll do nothing even if you ask us. Of course I'm not saying that. I am just saying that we just, you know, we don't need to think very hard, do we, to realize that unless we'll minister to one another and care to one another, unless we'll take on this priesthood and offer this sacrifice, we can forget the idea. Please, if what we've been saying about a caring church makes us nod our head, don't think that it'll be the onus on the staff to do it. There may be some structures we can set up and organise that can make it easier, but the weight has got to fall on all of us. And that's exactly where God intends it to be. He really doesn't have a two-tier church. He really doesn't have the few who do and the rest who sit. He really doesn't treat nine-tenths of his church as irresponsible or not up to it. No, he says, look, come to him. Come to that living stone and be yourselves like living stones built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood. To offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God. Well, then, let's turn our backs on such a privilege. Let's pray. Our sovereign God, thank you again for the way you order and shape your church. Thank you for the openness that being a church that centers on Christ gives it. Help us to be those who are constantly coming to him. Thank you for the privilege that being a holy priesthood gives to each one of us. Forgive us where we've backed off it in the past. Teach us and strengthen us and give us grace to offer to you the spiritual sacrifices that through Jesus are acceptable. And we ask it in his name. Amen.